Well, hello, anglers, and welcome to Kayak Fishing Radio. On Kayak Fishing... Where have I gone? Hello, anglers, and welcome to Kayak Fishing the Wild West on Kayak Fishing Radio, the angler's resource for what's happening in the sport today. I'm your host, Dennis Spike from KayakFishing.com, joined by my very fishy co-host, Isaac Miller in Portland, Oregon. How you doing, Isaac?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well.
I must have hit the wrong button on one of those intros, so I heard something I didn't hear, and then my eyes went astray, and I blew the oral intro, too. You got good weather up there in Portland?
Things are going really well up here. Well, I wouldn't say it's good weather, but, weather is as weather does. You got to get out there and fish anyway.
It's cool in California, but we got clear skies after a bunch of rain, and the inshore and the rivers and creeks are all full of fish. I wanted to tell listeners tonight that we are going to discuss a handful of topics as we get to them. I want to talk about the chi of wild fish, chi being vital energy, the stuff they talk about in Eastern medicine, the chi, the vital energy that runs through your body, applies to all things, and the quality of the food we eat. I want to talk about dressing for fishing. There were a couple of rescues on the coast near me over the weekend and some real hard lessons learned. Luckily, no lives were lost, and we'll all get a lot out of it. Lessons learned from mistakes and misfortunes. That's what that dressing for fishing is all about. And then we're going to get about mid-show. We should have a report from the boondoggle, and I believe they'll be calling in from South Carolina. Isaac thought it was a Florida thing, but no, I think all those Florida boys headed up north to South Carolina. So we'll see what's going on there. Who have we got calling in from the 978 area code? Anybody there checking in? Had him and lost him.
Yeah, had him and got him and was trying to get in there to see who it was, but lost him again.
I might be clicking them off every time they try, so I'll ask you to try one more time and beg your forgiveness for my lack of mastery on the switchboard. What an afternoon.
Yeah,
I went down to talk to... I'm sorry, there they are.
All right, the button on the left. Let me get them.
Okay, that's you, buddy.
There we go. Hey there, 978, somebody from Massachusetts, who we got on the line?
No, it's Chip, man. We're in
Charleston.
Yeah.
Right on.
I knew
here
it.
We got one call here. We got a 321 number.
It's a what? Chuck.
Chuck, welcome
Chuck
to the show, Redfish Chuck.
What's going on?
All right.
Same old, same old. Looking for another window of opportunity to get out on the water. How's everything shaping up for the boondoggle there, Chip? How's the weather looking?
It looks pretty good, man. A little windy this afternoon, but we're standing in Charleston Angler right now. They're going through a little raffle here for the after the captain's meeting.
We can hear it.
Great folks. Yeah, I got I've won a bucket liner, a hand paddle, and a set of pads for roof rack.
Cleaning up, man.
Mm-hmm.
How sweet it is. Wish I was there.
So it's cool. It looks like probably about 30, 35 folks showed up to the captain's meeting tonight. Maybe some more in the morning before we start fishing first light for the Redfish Shootout, supporting the Heroes on the Water, a great organization.
Right on.
Great bunch of guys, so supporting the right causes here.
That's fantastic. You know, I'm real active with the events for Heroes on the Water here on the West Coast. Don Danglin Anglin is one of their regional coordinators, and he's doing a fantastic job, about a half a dozen events a year at least. Getting those veterans out there and putting them on the water. So redfish is the target fish tomorrow, hon. Where are you fishing?
We'll be fishing the Cocoa Sound, just a little north of Charleston City. And there's, unfortunately, we're, the tides are kind of upside down for us, so we're going to be fishing a fallen tide. So we'll get out there first light, be about an hour after peak tide, and we'll run up onto some grass flats, look for some tailors, and then follow the water off into the deep channels and try to catch some fish as they start getting concentrated down in those areas of whole water at low tide.
You know, there's so many anglers around the country who'd have no idea that the Carolinas and pretty much the whole eastern seaboard has a tremendous skinny water fishery and those kinds of resources. Everybody thinks about eastern seaboard. They're looking at pictures of Cape Cod and Hatteras when the waves are blowing in. But the truth is that there are so many miles and miles of skinny water fishery up there. And the majority, I think, of kayak fishing, you know, it's the minority of people who are going out and fishing for offshore fish. I think most of it is done in the sounds and the inland waterways.
So I'd like to get a fellow here that I've been talking to earlier this evening. I'd like to get him on and have you guys talk to him. Ask him a few questions. What do you think?
Who you got?
All right, I'm going to hand the phone over to Tommy Samuels.
Hang Tommy. On.
How you doing there, Tommy?
Hello, how are you? Are you with me?
Who's taking the lead here, Isaac?
Go for it. It's all you.
How you doing, Tommy, and how's everything at the Boondoggle?
23. Oh, there it's pretty awesome. We're hanging out at the Charleston Angler in Somerville and getting ready for the guys are enjoying the Boondoggle, and we're getting ready for the Redfishville shootout for Heroes on the Water.
It was a good captain's meeting. You read everybody the law, and
yeah, we're trying to keep them straight. We busted out the map of Redfishville and showed everybody the hot spots. Of course, it does look like Ken Bergman cut out a couple of the really hot spots, but
yeah.
I'm sure everybody will find those tomorrow.
A little bit of creative editing, huh? Just follow the quiet fishermen.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, there's one or two guys here that we've already put chalk marks on their backs so that we know who to follow tomorrow.
Now, are you doing the Heroes events in your area?
Yeah, I'm the volunteer guide coordinator, so
right.
I loan boat equipment and services. And Ken Bergman is our chapter president.
Great. Well, we really support you guys and everybody that you're putting out on the water. And we wish you the best of luck tomorrow. We're really excited to hear who the winners are going to be.
Well, we're looking forward to putting on a good event. Looks like we're pushing 40 anglers that are registered, so it should be a really good, maybe our best tournament so far.
Now that's great. And you know, I know Chip's always looking at those tides and looking at the conditions, but I know from experience that it's just a matter of getting on the water. You guys are going to see some good fish tomorrow.
Yeah, we haven't started the betting yet, but my personal belief is it's going to be something over 30 inches. We'll take it tomorrow.
You got a few pools going for this event?
Not yet, but we will have before the night's over.
I'm sure they are. Well, thanks for joining us. I'm glad you could tune in. And like I said, we wish you all the best of luck tomorrow.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Be well, Tommy.
Bye now. You want to talk to somebody else?
Well, bring it on down.
All right. Let me see here. We're just getting some kind of safety issue here. You know, when we got these high tides, we're starting out with about a 5.8 at high, going down to a 0.6, 0.7 at the low. Luckily, we're not doing a negative tide here.
That's a pretty big swing.
Yeah, so, you know, you got to worry about getting high-sided on the mud out here, and you don't want to get stuck in the mud, so.
Yeah, boy, ain't that the truth. That could be a very long day.
So how's things going out there, man?
It's going pretty good. It's been a busy, busy week for kayakfishing.com, and I think it's going to do nothing but get busier, which I like, because this time of year on the fishing front, things kind of slow down. You don't get as much guiding work, although that crab should change it around for me. But I got a lot. I got a few new things. I was telling you on the show last night about that rescue, and just so many good safety tips and education for anglers coming out of that. I think later on the show we're going to focus about that a little bit. And Isaac and I are going to talk about the chi of wild fish. You know, we talk a lot about looking for fish and catching fish, but we talk so little about eating fish, and there is so much variation in what is available, whether we're fishing, whether we're catching it ourselves, which is the optimum meat resource, to what we're buying in the store. And we're going to talk about hot tips, and since I got a fishmonger right here online, I think we're going right to the horse's mouth.
Yeah, you are. Give me about 10 minutes here, and I'll get the coordinator for the show on. All right,
Chip, thanks. And we'll roll into something else. Be looking for you.
All right, I'll be right back.
So, Isaac.
Yeah.
How you doing, man? Hey, Chuck, Redfish Chuck quietly hiding in the background there. Tell me a story.
Ditch tarpon, man. I haven't been fishing out on the big water in a while, and the wind's been blowing down here real bad. We had some serious wind blow through today, 20 to 30 knots gusts, and, rainy conditions on and off. So the thing that I'm looking forward to is kind of non-kayak fishing related. I'm looking to go back and get on some more of them little ditch tarpon. So all on the fly rod.
That's fishing the canals, right?
Yeah, man.
Oh, with your fly rod, that's got to be a blast. And what are those, little schooling tarpons?
Yeah, little small ones, little juveniles. Yeah. I use a 5-weight, keep it nice and light, give the fish kind of a halfway bit of a chance. And,
that's so much fun. You know, it's funny, a lot of people make the comment to me, oh, you wouldn't want to do that because the fish aren't very big. I don't care how big the fish are. I just want to see some action. I can always scale it down to make it sporting, and that's what you're doing with that 5-weight.
Yeah, man, and I've gone down as light as a 4-pound tippet to really make it kind of interesting. And these little tiny tarpon, man, they're everywhere. There's literally hundreds of them if you know where you're going.
Wow.
And you present a fly that looks anything halfway edible, they'll eat it. And it's been really cool for me because I've been tying up a lot of these flies that I'm using, and it's given me a great opportunity to kind of learn these fishes' behaviors and what they'll take and what they won't take and how they like it presented and everything else. So I have a bit of a smorgasbord in my fly box at the moment.
The poo-poo platter?
That's right, that's right.
I got to believe that a little tiny tarpon puts up a walloper of a fight.
It's actually pretty cool. I started catching them on I have a 7 and an 8-weight combo that I usually use for redfish and trout and stuff, and that was just too heavy for these little fish. So
sure.
I scaled back to that 5-weight, and that's the answer, man. It's a lot of fun. And my fly rod is real short, and it's kind of surprising. It's only 7'6".
Little shotgun?
So, yeah, so I can really get in close to the mangroves and make little, you know, sidearm casts and underhand kind of flips and stuff like that with the rod. So it works out well.
Nice. Well, there's a report for you. I'm still feeding on old reports. I went to the Red Barn Classic last weekend to catch the weigh-in and run into a few friends and fishermen. And the fishing was slow, but, you know, sometimes it's a bummer. I mean, the afternoon wind comes up, or they call a tournament at 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and some days it's just an afternoon bite, and that's the way it is. So the fish coming into the scales, it was a pretty light catch for the event. Although there were a handful of people who came in with their limit of 10 fish, they were looking for the trifecta, lingcod, cabazon, and their biggest rockfish, and nobody landed a cabazon big enough to retain. So, but I did see a 20-pound king salmon walk up, and nearly 20-pound lingcod, too. So there were some fish caught. I mentioned on Chip Show yesterday that there was a rescue. Actually, one guy rescued another guy after his boat filled up with water and not only submerged. I'm sure most everybody's aware that polyethylene will stay on the surface if you sink your boat. However, this boat did not stay on the surface, and it sank out of sight. And these guys had 2.5 brutal hours, the last of it in the dark, to get to shore. Yeah, but they made it out okay. One guy got pretty shook up about it all. And, you know, you're in cold water only wearing 3 millimeters of neoprene. You can't do that in cold water. And, you know, every once in a while I'll be going out on the coast here and there's a guy in his shorts and barefoot. And it just seems so reckless. But then once a guy has to swim in a 3 millimeter wetsuit, you realize just how reckless that is. You know, there's a lot of that waterman attitude out there, but part of being a waterman is being smart enough to not get in trouble and dress in.
Hey, guys.
Go ahead.
Yeah, hang on. I got the director here of the tournament. I'd like for you to talk to him.
And who's that?
It's Hey,
you're
how you doing, Tim Bergman?
Thanks.
Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Great. Good to have you on here. How's things looking out that way?
Everything is looking great. The first year we had the tournament, we had, I think, 18 anglers. Our second year, we had 28, and it looks like we'll have definitely close to 40 this year. So our attendance is getting bigger every year. Just the awareness of Heroes in the Water, not only our chapter here in South Carolina and Charleston, we have a new chapter in Columbia as well. We're getting some visibility for those guys. My friends up in North Carolina, Virginia, Florida, Texas, all the other guys. It's kind of really building a lot of visibility so that everybody knows about Heroes in the Water, and we're able to get sponsorship more sharp, be able to, you know, get stuff taken care of for those guys all over the country, not just here in South Carolina.
East Coast, Texas, West Coast, Heroes is probably the biggest nonprofit related to the sport, and what a great cause.
Yeah. For me, it was I came back from Iraq in 2006 with a busted up shoulder and wasn't feeling too good, and fly fishing is something I've always loved and always done and really enjoyed, and it was kind of like my therapy, my way to kind of get away and get my head straight. And when I came back, I asked a friend of mine, I was like, hey, man, how about, you know, is there a chapter of Project Healing Waters or something like that that I can, you know, give some back and help out with? And a friend of mine told me, he says, hey, man, why don't you contact Jim Dolan? He's got a program that he's starting up called Heroes in the Water, and they do kayak fishing. And I've been kayak fishing for a couple of years. So I called Jim, and he was really excited, and I was able to, you know, set this chapter up here in South Carolina and take some of my, you know, my friends that, you know, were over there with me that were hurt, some other guys that I knew that I've met, you know, through the program, take them out and give them that opportunity to just kind of get out, kind of, you know, forget all the stuff that's going on and just, you know, concentrate on, you know, getting some fluff mud behind your ears and catching some redfish. And it's just been something near and dear to my heart, something I really enjoy doing.
That's a blessing. Are we there, boys? I lost my speaker for a sec.
Yeah, I'm still here. I was like, oh, I could hang up on
him. Well, Ken, I'm excited for you. It's great to see it growing like that. And you've been, two years, three events, you've doubled your participation there.
Yeah, we're looking forward. We're working on, we've got some, Heroes in the Water is actually getting a lot bigger. We've got some wheels in motion that are actually getting us a little more organized, getting us to the point where it's really becoming a nationwide organization to where we're all kind of on the same program so that when somebody wants to start up a new program or a new chapter, they're not like I was. It was just kind of like, okay, you're a chapter. Okay, what do? Go fish. So I had to, you know, do a lot of pounding the pavement and finding local sponsors and, you know, just trying to get contacts to get gear donated and rods and reels and places to fish and stuff like that. And I passed that on to other guys, and they would pass it on. It was kind of, you know, piecemeal. But now we're going to get these wheels in place to it where when somebody starts a new chapter, they're going to have all that stuff, have more of like a handbook to kind of help them get started.
So everybody isn't starting from scratch every time.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I had dinner with Jim Dolan back at Vegas this year, right just the day before ICAST started up, and learned a lot of stuff. There's some exciting stuff coming to Heroes on the Water this year. I'm excited.
Yeah, just in the last 2 years, almost 3 years now, I mean, it went from, you know, a bunch of kayak fishermen that were trying to, you know, give back and help out some of our, you know, our men and women that were, you know, injured. And I mean, I came back from Iraq injured, but I came back and a lot better shape than a lot of other people, and I know what it does for me, so I wanted to give that back. There's a lot of us are in the same boat, and, you know, we wanted to do that, and it was kind of, you know, we're getting all this stuff done, and we're having a great time, and now it's just turning into something that's really expanding, really getting bigger, and just getting so much better so that we can, you know, really take care of our guys and I mean, we've had, you know, people here that, you know, would talk to me in one-syllable words, yeah, no, Colin, wouldn't you make eye contact? And within 20 minutes on the water, they're babbling 1,000 miles a minute. They, you know, they wouldn't shut up, and they were just so excited to be out there. And, you know, this is the best day I've had in the last 2 years, you know, that kind of thing. So it's, you know, you get guys out, and, you know, you're able to give them that by just putting them in a kayak and saying, hey, man, the fish are over here. You know, let me know if you need any help. And,
it means,
you know, help
a lot.
Them out,
it means
on.
A
it
lot.
Does.
Well, thanks for that. I wish you guys the best of success tomorrow.
All right, great. I have a blog called the Breakfish Chronicles. It's on Blogspot.
Why don't you say that slower?
Sunday afternoon or Monday, I'll have the results up for the tourney, and I'll be posting them on CharlestonFishing.com and Kayak Fishing, SouthCarolinaKayakFishing.com.
Great.
I'll be posting all the results up from that.
Great. Thanks for that.
All righty.
All right, whack 'em, you guys.
All right. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Adios.
Thank you.
Yep, bye-bye.
I'm going to take this moment real quick. To anybody that's listening in, if you're in the chat room or if you're listening in on the audio, if you've got any questions, want to get on the show, give us a phone call. That phone number is 714-816-4727. We can get you on the air. Of course, you can also get onto the chat room. You can find the chat room on Blog Talk Radio or on kayakfishingradio.com. Get in there. We'll see your questions come up. We'll do our best to get those answered for you. And while you're at kayakfishingradio.com, don't forget on that website, you're going to find our links for all the other Kayak Fishing Radio shows, as well as our links to our Facebook accounts. Friend us on Facebook. Like us on Facebook. Go to Twitter. Become friends on Twitter. Follow us on there. That's the best way to keep up with all the Kayak Fishing Radio shows. Just wanted to get that plug in there. Thank you very
beautiful
much.
Beautiful thing, Isaac.
Hey, done that a time or two, I guess.
You know, we really can't. Ken was talking about the quality of experience that a lot of these veterans who've gotten shot up, blown up, torn up over in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the great experience they're getting out of kayak fishing. And, you know, it just, I can't say enough about how fast this new sport has become part of the community and gone outside of our community. And it's just great to see, you know, and I know exactly what he's talking about. I went with Don Danglin to out to Livermore. I can't remember the name of the lake, but it was just a great event. They had about 15 or 20 vets out there and a bunch of other vets, guys who you know, from Vietnam, even back to Korea, who are just out there as volunteers, want to meet the veterans and get on the water, do some fishing with them. And it's just, it's, the experience is overwhelming. It really is something else.
That's
Let's
awesome.
Let's change the subject, Isaac. I want to talk about fish.
Let's talk about fish, because that's what we're here, Kayak Fishing Radio.
We still like got fish. Redfish Chuck on board?
Yeah, man.
Hey, Chuck, what's the last fish you ate?
Last fish I had was mahi or dolphin fish.
You bought it from the store?
Actually, I got it at a restaurant, but yeah.
That's a good pick for the restaurants. You know, mahi is the fastest, to my knowledge, the fastest growing sport fish in the sea.
Yes, sir. They only live about 5 years, too. They're one of the quickest ones to die.
So you're telling me that even a Dorado, a mahi-mahi that's 50, 60 pounds, is only a five-year-old fish?
Yep. I've been involved with doing some dolphin tagging myself. And one of the guys who runs the program has found that small juvenile fish, 20, 25, 30 inches, captured in, let's say, South Florida, recaptured up in the Carolinas, only to be a few months later, gained, I believe it was 10 to 15 pounds of weight.
I believe that.
So,
they are
voracious
eaters.
Yeah, they are. And if you've ever been out, I know you have, Spike, but if you've ever been out and you've seen a big wad of dolphin or mahi or dorado, whatever you call it, wherever you live, If you ever seen them feed on a weed line, it's the most incredible thing you'll ever see in your entire life. They can literally pick every stitch of life off a weed line in a matter of seconds.
I've seen them do it in open water to a bait ball until there was no bait ball left in the water.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of footage of that now. That Michael Folks from Inside Sport Fishing television show, he's got that on his intro. Dorados and sailfish just pecking away at a bait ball. The reason I bring it up is we have a lot of choices when we go to the supermarket or we go to the restaurant. And there was a time that I used to only consume fish that I bought. But then I started learning about the fish that I caught. But then I started learning about the fish that I bought. And there's a lot to learn there, as our fishmonger Isaac is going to reinforce quite a bit, I'm sure. And my point being, there's a lot of great fish out there. There's a lot of really bad fish, and not only the fish, but other seafood choices as well. And I wanted to share with listeners a few of the tips. So when I had a radio show here in Occidental California, Fish in the Wine Country, I did a little segment every time. I'd pick out the ads from the Sunday paper. It was a Sunday morning show. And our supermarkets generally, Isaac, I think you'll probably agree that the fish counter in a supermarket is a loss leader and they're more for eye appeal than to make a profit?
Pretty much.
That is accurate, isn't it?
That is, yeah.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is they spend millions of dollars on seafood. I don't know what the waste in a retail supermarket chain is, but I've got to imagine the waste is pretty significant. And there's lots of offerings there, and especially shrimp. Shrimp is probably among the most popular seafoods in the world, and it's consumed by everyone everywhere. And the shrimp farming, the aquaculture for shrimp, is some of the worst impact farming that has ever hit the planet. In different parts of the world, because of shrimp farming, we're virtually destroying entire mangrove coasts to make a buck. And I love shrimp. There were a bunch of years that I quit eating it because it was such a bad thing until I found Gulf shrimp from Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi. And they sell it as white shrimp. They sell it as wild shrimp. And over the years, you know, it wasn't always a great resource because for every few pounds of shrimp you ate, you weren't tasting the turtle, but the turtle was there. Not to mention a lot of other sea life, including birds and mammals, bycatch from fish, bycatch of juvenile fish in massive quantities that were just dumped back into the sea. Over the years, the fishing gear, the restrictive gear for shrimping has improved so much that we've actually got a shrimp fishery in the Gulf White Shrimp that I believe is considered sustainable. Isaac?
It's a good alternative. It's a yellow tag under the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch program. So it's not to say that it's good. It's not to say that it's bad. It's like I said, they call it a good alternative. As far as I know, when it comes to shrimp, there's only one that's considered best choice. And, you know, the Gulf Coast shrimp is the only one that's considered a good alternative. Anything else from anywhere else in the world, wild caught and or farmed, is red. It's bad. Best left to be avoided.
Right, right. Now, you said the best choice. Is that the Pacific Bay shrimp?
That is. That's the Oregon Bay shrimp. That's the one.
And what a wonderful product that is. This is a fishery they've probably been tapping for 50, 60, 70 years.
Right. You know, and the bay shrimp has not always been the best choice.
Was it overfished?
The bay fish, it's not that it was overfished, but bycatch made it a not-so-good choice.
The gear has improved very well.
It's improved immensely, and I've actually seen video footage of these nets underwater, and it is amazing because they catch these bay shrimp. I said, they call them bay shrimp. They're not catching them in the bay.
No. They're offshore.
They are well offshore. They're running these nets deep underwater.
And let me interject something there, Isaac. For listeners who don't know what we're talking about, if you go into the store, they usually run anywhere from, say, $3 to $6 a pound. These are the little tiny cooked red shrimps that they use for shrimp cocktails. And those are not the big shrimps for shrimp cocktails, but the little ones, like in the prepackaged shrimp cocktails that have those tiny little shrimps with cocktail sauce already in it. And that is the Oregon Bay shrimp.
Yeah. And like I said, they catch these offshore pretty deep water. And the main bycatch used to be halibut and rockfish. They just get sucked up into these nets, and, you know, they're there to die.
Right, they're done.
They're done. You know, they're not being sold. They get pulled up on the boat, thrown overboard. You know, it was a horrible waste of the fish. But now they do have a really cool escape mechanism on these nets. And I saw a video from, you know, underwater from harvesting these shrimp, and you'd see these big 5-6 foot halibut get, you know, they'll just find their way in the net. Every once in a while, they'll just swim off and be done. There was a couple that kind of hung out and said, hey, I'm getting a free ride and free food.
So they're feeding inside of that net.
They were feeding inside of the net.
Unbelievable.
When they were done. Yeah, when they were done, they just swam out of it. And it's basically what they did is they've got this net, which is basically kind of a funnel-shaped design. And at the base of the funnel, they basically put in a manhole cover. So that way, anything bigger than a little 2-inch shrimp
gets pushed off to the side.
Or they can kind of ride along with it.
Huh.
And that's what a lot of these fish did. I saw a video, the video I saw had rockfish and halibut. And every once in a while, they just kind of swim along with it because here's this big funnel of food coming right their way.
Wow.
They'd snack a little bit, but then they'd peel off whenever they wanted.
Now, those were adult fish. I think one of the big issues in the past has been the massive amount of juvenile fish. I mean, they were able to get whole concentrations, especially the spawning rockfish, not the spawning rockfish, but the spawn itself. There's a fish on the Pacific coast, or Southern California, called calico bass, and that's one of the kelp basses. And I was fishing probably 300 miles south of Malibu in northern Baja California, and fishing on my kayak on the near shore, and all of a sudden I was in a school of calico bass fry. They were 2 to 3 inch calico basses, 1 to 3 inch calico basses, and just an incredible biomass of fish, millions and millions of fish. Now, this is a designated sport-only fish in California. The kelp basses, which would be sand bass and calico bass, they're not allowed to take or for commercial purposes or sell them in the markets. So there's a big push, you know, for release and to protect the calico bass. And for me to be in the middle of this swarm of fry, this incredible biomass, which I kid you not was about an acre in size, and watching the pelicans come down and fill their gullets with these things, you know, it really is an amazing thing. You know, there's so many controversies, too, that exist with all of this, and there was one hot on my tongue when you were talking before, but I'll have to dig it back out and see what it was. I think the controversies were something about farm raised, and I apologize. I'll get back to that.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine that type of biomass of fry.
It was. I had never seen it before, and I actually saw it again a couple years later. It's just incredible. And, you know, these are things that you talk to anglers in boats, their whole lifetime, they never see anything like this. And I think the unique lack of invasiveness of the kayaks has a lot to do with some of the experiences we see on the water. You know, whether it's sea life, whether it's finfish or mammals. Some of the things I've seen with mammals, whether it's bull sea lions growling at me during the rut, how was I to know there's a rut in the water? to three dolphins copulating in what I can only describe as a threesome. You know, these are things that we don't get to see when we have a motor on our boat. It's just so rare. The times that gray whales have come up and covered my fishing partners with spray. One time I looked up, I just had a sense, and a guy was up against a rock ledge. This is in northern Baja, up down in Mexico. He's up against the coast, but it's a rock ledge, and it's 120 feet below him, going straight down. All of a sudden, a gray whale pins him to the rock, going by at about 25 miles an hour, and blows, and all you looked over, it looked like a cascade of white, frosty waterfall. And
wow.
And now that whale did that on purpose. I guarantee you that whale did that on purpose. I even saw a smile on his face as he went by. But I think the experiences we get, you know, that's the kind of stuff we see and get to appreciate on a kayak. And it is totally unique to anything else. Again, in a kayak, most anglers, I believe, probably get 10 times more time on the water every year than they would if they had to fuss and bother with a motorboat. And definitely
it's a lot
more,
easier.
Definitely more than anglers get who are fishing the headboats based on time and cost alone. You know, getting back to the Chia wild fish, I'm sure most people know, but not everybody. Before I took up my fishing career back in 1995, I was practicing acupuncture. I went to a Chinese medical school in the Wilshire District of Los Angeles and got my degree in acupuncture and herbology. Before that, I had worked a couple of vocations, but one of them was the burn center at Sherman Oaks Hospital. They made a name for themselves back in the days of Grizzly Adams and Richard Pryor. And that got me into the healthcare, or got me back into the healthcare thing. And I was practicing acupuncture, fishing from my kayak, and because of that education, which I put on the shelf, you know, seeing patients many years ago, I guess it's probably, gosh, it's got to be 10 years ago, since I've been in the clinic. And but I didn't want that, what I learned there, to go to waste, and a lot of it ties in, a lot of the nutrition in an acupuncture education. A lot of again, I'll use the nutrition in personal nutrition in the Eastern society is a lot different than what we've got here today. And one of the things that, you know, when I look at the high incidence of diabetes in the United States, in the developed countries especially, compared to other countries where there's a lot more poverty, you look at what they're eating, and it's the source of the food. And I use the term qi. The point I'm getting to, and I hate to bore everyone with this, is I've been writing a lot of articles lately that are loosely titled The Qi of Wild Fish. And I'm trying to think. I think Kayak Angler magazine published one a couple of years ago. And I think it was under that title, The Qi of Wild Fish. But when we think about what we're putting into us, you know, when you consider a loaf of fresh-baked bread from the bakery and a loaf of Wonder Bread from the supermarket that has several weeks of shelf life, when you look at milk that's being grown on a factory farm for milk production versus milk that comes from a dairy where the cows eat grass and get to range and are called in twice a day for their milking. In Eastern medical and nutritional thought, they talk about the chi of the food and the energy of the food. And here in America, we've got a real strong push these days towards locally grown, locally raised, organic. And it's funny because when I moved to Mexico back in, it was around 2005, I moved my business down there to run it off the beach in near Cabo. And I remember saying to myself when I moved down there, oh, I'm never going to be able to eat the same. Because although it's tacos and burritos and chicken and not the greatest beef you've ever seen in the world, it's local, it's fresh. Organic really doesn't mean anything in Mexico. But with that local or that local quality and that fresh quality, I really thought I wouldn't be able to eat the same until I moved north of San Francisco to Sonoma, where a lot of the meals that we prepare at home, whether it's breakfast, lunch, or dinner, are grown and raised and milked and cheesed literally within 20 or 30 miles of the house. And when you there's an old saying that and you've heard the elderly say it a lot, you're only as good as what you put into you. And that is absolutely true. So when we look at a king salmon, a coho salmon that comes out of a river, stream, or comes out of the ocean, and then we look at a salmon that is raised in a pen with pellet feed, processed feed, antibiotics, coloring agents, and no room to swim, we think about the chi of the food. The same with genetically engineered grains, fruits, and vegetables, and highly fertilized versus the crops that are allowed to grow and mature. I remember when I was younger and I first started thinking about organic foods and seeing them in the stores, and the one thing that I always noticed is it looked terrible. The organic stuff, the natural stuff, always looked bad. But years of farming innovations, that's not the case anymore. And I think with our organic fruits and produces, and even the meats and fishes, the no doubt about it when it comes to salmon, the quality, the flavor of these products, when they're wild, when they're organic, is much better than the farmed version of it. Now, salmon's a classic example, but you can run all the way down the line with the shrimps and other seafoods, where on the other hand, there's an exception. These are not steadfast rules. A lot of our seafoods, right, like clams off the East Coast, I believe, are being farmed in the open ocean.
East and West Coast, for that matter. Clams and mussels.
And certain fish, like tilapia and catfish, are good value fish, and they have a good quality chi as a food value.
Right. The freshwater fishes, being the tilapia, the catfish, the trouts, must be farmed. They have to be farmed. There is no wild-caught fishery, wild-catch fishery
for those
rainbow
species.
Trout.
Right.
For tilapia, for catfish.
Right.
And in the case, becomes a real big case of know where your fish comes from. In the case of the trouts and catfish especially, make sure they're coming from the United States, because then you know that they are being raised on a private pond, and there's going to be, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is going to control the way that pond operates, the way the water is filtered.
Isaac. That's huge.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been seeing the reports lately about freshwater farmed fish coming from other countries and what's in them.
Right. And that's the biggest thing. You have to know where your fish is coming from.
Absolutely.
And, also by law from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, your local fishmonger has to have a label saying exactly where that fish comes from. And they have to be able to provide evidence. They have to be able to provide proof that where they said that fish came from is where it actually came from. So there's a lot that goes into that. But, you know, like I said, as far as the freshwater fishes go, farmed is the only way to go. It's the healthiest choice for our waters and for the wild fish. Because I couldn't imagine, you know, a boat on, say, the Rogue River here in Oregon commercially fishing rainbow trout. You know, so, and that's why the freshwater fishes are only available farmed.
Right.
So, throw that out there.
I needed to make a correction that I've stated on a couple of shows. There, I spoke to Captain Ernie Prieto on the Chubasco 2 down in Point Loma. Ernie passed on some secondhand information that wasn't quite accurate, and that information was, what he told me was that since we've started using lobster report cards, that's the spiny lobster here in Southern California, that we've got about 150 commercial lobster fishermen here in California, and we're selling about 30,000 recreational lobster punch cards. Now,
wow.
The information Ernie gave me was that the recreational take is 30% higher than the commercial take, and I just got a notice from Fish and Game saying that is not accurate. But since we are keeping records, the recreational take is about 50% of the commercial take, and that is significant. That is because that exists in very few fisheries where the recreational take comes anywhere near that. Usually recreational take is way below 10% of the commercial take of any species.
Right.
But now that they're using the punch cards and doing this reporting, we're getting a much better picture of the fishery. And that all leads to incredible efforts towards sustainability. I wanted to add one more thing, Isaac, and that is down in, I believe it was Huntington Beach. Let me see if I can grab my press release. They have been busting lobster poachers, I tell you. No, it's actually Redondo Beach, which is King Harbor. And that's the south end of Los Angeles County. They are busting lobster poachers. And they're going after the impact poachers because resources are scarce and bodies in Fish and Game are scarce for these types of investigations. However, they did get a group of people 2 days before the season opened and busted them with 132 spiny lobsters. Lots of them were undersized. On the same shift, those wardens were able to go out and make four more arrests for poaching. That is a productive shift working for the fisheries. And we need to see this in the press. You know, I think a lot of this poaching stuff, while people know, they don't understand. And I think if people understood, it would help us with all but the worst greedy poachers, and those are the ones who are out there fishing for money.
Right. And that's, I mean, anybody taking home 130 lobsters.
132 or 137. I've seen I've seen pictures of boats, both for lobster and that have been busted for both lobster and abalone poaching that had false bottoms in the boats. And when the wardens came on board and found the false floors, underneath the boats had hundreds and hundreds of specimens.
Oh, my goodness. I can't.
And we're just starting. You know, it used to be a slap on the wrist.
Right.
But now you've got, especially in Sonoma and Mendocino counties, Contra Costa County, which is where San Francisco is, you've got some judges who are fishermen now. And they're starting to pay attention to the fishery. And not only fishermen, you've got judges who are conservationists. And they're starting to listen to fish and game biologists. They're starting to listen to the angler lobbyists and community and realizing that their slap on the wrist for poaching hasn't done anything for the fisheries. So now they're starting to get pretty hardcore. People are getting time. They're getting big fines. They're getting fishing privilege revoked for life.
Losing boats.
Crimes against nature, baby. We won't have it.
Yeah. Good.
Oh yeah, they're losing boats. They're losing everything. If you're driving a car, you get busted. You're never going to see that car or truck again. So, but the crazy thing is, a lot of these serial poachers, you know, before they finally go down, there have been a lot of reports on them lately, and there's a handful of them that got busted, and got busted big, and then were busted a second time within weeks of getting out of jail. Before their original cases even went to court.
This is, I mean, you know, this is just as bad as the drug trade.
You know, it's all,
you know,
if there wasn't money in all of it, nobody'd be doing any of it. And you're right, it is just as bad. It is just as bad. It has a bad social impact. You know, I mean, you can go all the way down the list.
Wow.
So, Chuck, you're being mighty quiet over there.
It depends. Does he still have his ears on?
Does he? I think he might.
I'm still here, buddy.
We got him. You got any plans for the weekend, young man, besides working?
Absolutely. I'm going to walk some dike roads with my son and see if we can't catch us a couple dozen little juvenile tarpons and ladyfish and trout and whatever various other creatures want to play.
It ain't kayak fishing, but I think you still got to get a picture and get it out to us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. I see pictures all the time with the phone. So, yeah, the water down here is absolutely horrid, and there's no sense in going. You can't see anything. It looked like Yoo-Hoo at best. And, you know, we're starting to get our first couple cool-down snaps down here in Florida where, like, it's been in the 60s in the morning. And, you know, we get a couple more of those that'll help to kill off all that algae we got living in the river, and that'll clean it up real good. And I'll be back in the kayak, man. Back in the saddle.
Right on.
We haven't even had a 60-degree day for a high in a week.
I'll trade you.
It was, yeah. We just got a cold snap. You know, we have. In fact, up in Lake Tahoe in the Sierras, they got a foot and a half of snow up there right now from the storm that blew in last week.
Yep.
And I'm telling you, it's all global cooling, except where Chuck's at. I tell
you,
every time I go to Florida and I'm driving around and I see those canals, and I'm just, especially down like Fort Lauderdale area, I've spent a lot of time down there, I look at that, and Fort Lauderdale and up north towards Boca and all that, I look at it, I know it's got to be nothing but fish in there.
Dude, there is not a body of water in the state that doesn't have fish in it. Even the little tiny ponds.
That is Florida, man.
Yeah, the little tiny ponds off the side of the interstate by the exit ramps and things like that just are basically just rain catchers.
And then nobody ever throws a line on.
No, absolutely not. And they're all full of bass and specks and all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, this is like fisherman's paradise down here if you're a well-rounded angler and you like to do everything. So,
yeah.
Oh, hey, I'll be down there next summer. So,
I cast?
Yeah, I cast. I'll be there. I'm making a long trip this time.
Yeah, maybe I'll join you there, Isaac. I'm due.
There's a lot more fish
down
in Florida.
We'll be more than happy to put you guys on some fish down here. I wanted to add something real quick. I know you're kind of coming close on time.
No, not at all. We're good.
I used to work for a seafood processing plant here in Port Canaveral, Florida. It was called Blue Point Fisheries, and their main target species was scallops. And you're talking about bycatch and how badly some of those net boats are for the environment and everything. I'll tell you what, man, there used to be beautiful ridges off of our coast, beautiful coral heads off our coast, and you know, 5-foot reliefs where fish would hide up under, groupers would hide up underneath those reliefs and stuff. And all those drag nets over the years of just pounding that thing down to the ground.
They've graded
them flat. And, but not even just that. The bycatch was the thing that shocked me. And I was kind of dumb to the whole commercial fishing side of things going into the job because to me it was a paycheck. And, after working there for a couple of weeks, I almost found it unbearable to go back to work because while I am not a, I guess what you would call it,
typical. I'd call it a tree-hugging environmentalist.
Thank you. I was trying to be politically correct.
That is politically correct.
There you go. While I'm not a tree-hugger environmentalist, I do hunt deer and pigs and turkeys, and I enjoy being outside and feeding my family off the land. The sight of all of the bycatch that was on these scallop boats, because it's not like a shrimp boat where they go out and they catch their shrimp and then they sort their shrimp out on the deck and they pitch all their bycatch over the back end and blackfin tunas are there to eat up all the garbage and stuff. These scallop boats just dump their catch on the deck and just pile it up like a big sandcastle and come rolling into the port with just a giant mound of scallops. Higher than you stand. And in that pile of scallops is everything. And most of it was still relatively alive when it gets back because they go out and they scallop all night long and they come back the next morning.
Sort of.
Make a long story short, they had big clam trucks that would pick up these big piles of scallops, you know, by scoop loads and dump them onto a shaker table, which would sort the scallops from the larger bycatch. And, grouper, snapper, thousands of flounder. I can't tell you how many invertebrates. Giant, huge, horseshoe crabs, like the biggest horseshoe crabs I've ever seen in my life. Giant hermit crabs. In fact, the biggest thing I ever seen come off the boat was a normal southern stingray that was probably 10 to 12 foot across.
Oh, man.
It was at the bottom of the pile. Was one of the first things to be dumped on the deck when the nets were opened up.
Right.
And the deckhands can't lift a creature that big. There's nobody on this planet that's that strong.
Right.
So they had, the poor thing was dead, and they had to, get a crane in to pick it up off the boat. And all they did basically is they ran a rope through its head, through its gills, or its breathing openings.
Right.
And then just cut the rope and let it drop into the water and basically rot on the bottom. So
that's so messed up.
Oh, it is so messed up. And while I found it hard to take watching all of these to me edible species, lobsters included, we had what we call down here peekaboo crabs or rooster crabs, which I don't believe have a commercial value, which to me are one of the best eaten crab claws I've ever had in my life. But anyhow, all these edible creatures going up this conveyor belt into the bed of a dump truck who would just take it off to the landfill and just dump it.
And future generations of great fish stocks.
That's literally what they did. They would take all of these fish. So what I started doing is I'd bring two or three coolers with me to work, and I'd work on the hopper table, or I'd be near the guy working on the hopper table and be like, look, you get flounder coming by, throw them in these coolers. Hops are coming off, throw them in the coolers. Get the peekaboo crabs, throw them in the coolers. And I would feed an army of my buddies and my family with, basically bycatch.
That was going to be rotted out somewhere.
That was going to be rotted out somewhere. And most of it, like I said, was still alive when it hit the hopper table. So it was definitely bad. It got to be so bad that they actually ran themselves out of business. There was no scallops left. Every year you'd see the scallop catches go down and down and down to the point to where finally they just closed shop. All the scallop boats left. But what we do have here is rock shrimp. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with rock shrimp.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Rock shrimp, this is actually, I believe, where the rock shrimp commercial fishery began, because the guys that own Dixie Crossroads here in Titusville owned the first, I guess what you would call a rock shrimp boat, and the guy designed the apparatus that splits the shell of the rock shrimp, which makes it a lot easier to clean the whole nine yards. The rock shrimp fishery out here has been pretty stellar for the last couple of years, and in fact, if you're out here bottom fishing at night offshore in, let's say, just a private boat, and you turn on the floodlights, there's nights where you can scoop them things up by the hundreds. They come all the way up to the surface and swim across the surface and stuff. So that's one shrimp fishery that seems to be okay. But we also get those whites.
Now, the shrimp fishery, though, that rockfish shrimp fishery, isn't that the one that they closed down about 10 or 15 years ago to recover the fishery?
I think they closed rock shrimp down about 10 or 15 years ago to do that because of the how fast it became like the next thing. You know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right, right. Just like the redfish.
Right.
But I remember one time I was in Florida, and man, the local fishermen. I mean, it was already several years after the fact, and they were just crying about, because they lost their fishery. It wasn't they had to go into another business if they wanted to stay in fishing, because apparently there is no real, or at that time there was no commercial fishery for the shrimp at all.
Yeah, and well now, I mean, it's pretty big business here now.
So they're back at it.
Yeah, we actually see a lot of shrimp boats certain times of the year off the coast, which is always a welcome sight for us fishermen because, as I said before, the blackfin tunas and bonitas and kingfish and sharks and everything else like to hang out off their
right.
aft end whenever they're cleaning off their decks. Right, but one thing that has been decimated here has been our clam stock and our oysters and that kind of thing. There's actually a couple of folks that are farming them here and have leases on property on the river where they've have like oyster farms or what have you down near Sebastian Inlet and some of the more higher salinity areas with all of the development that's gone on in Brevard County where I live over the past, say, 10 to 15 years, the clam industry has just been destroyed. And some folks blame the clammers for over-exploiting it. Others, you know, blame it on the salinity level in the river being too low, almost too fresh for the clams that we were having here in the Indian and Banana Rivers. And I remember as a kid going out and digging things up with my feet, as many as you wanted.
And it doesn't happen anymore, huh?
Nah, man, listen, I would challenge anybody to go out and dig with their feet a bushel of clams now. I mean, unless you know where there are some clams hanging out and hiding, they're just gone.
You know, people are quick to blame the commercial fishermen, and especially people from our side of the fence. But I got to tell you the truth. I blame a failure in fishery management for all of this happening, you know, because the bottom line is the fishermen, I've got to appreciate generations of ingraining and fishing for a legal fishery. And if it's a legal fishery that's being devastated, it should have been managed long before it got to that point. And I think that's where we're going state by state with all of our direction towards sustainability. But, you know, these guys overfished fisheries, and they were, in a lot of cases, subsidized to do it when the fishing was bad. And they were doing something that wasn't illegal. So, you know, I really don't blame the fishermen. I tend to blame the states.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I'm right there with you. In fact, a few of my best friends are commercial fishermen and hook and line fishermen.
Uh-huh.
And anybody that has an argument that hook and line fishermen are destroying the fish population.
They're just not paying you. They're not educated if they're making that argument.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like, for instance, one of my buddies, he has what we call down here a reef permit, and with that you can catch and keep your groupers, your snappers, your amberjack, and that kind of thing.
Right.
And he can go out and catch 1,000 pounds of greater amberjack in a day. Who the hell wants to catch 1,000 pounds of greater amberjack rod and reel in a day? Like, I'm sure, I know you've caught them before, Spike, so, I mean, it's not exactly a fish that
you know. A couple fish down the road, and I'm handing that rod off.
That's right. And these guys, and it's usually just my one buddy and his little brother who's still in school, who's still in high school. They go out on the weekends and they'll catch, you know, 1,000 pounds of amberjack, a few hundred pounds of grouper, some cobias mixed in, and that kind of thing. But it's all hook and line and live bait.
That's a lot of work, man.
It is, and it's almost sustainable in itself just because of the pure numbers and the idea of having to hand crank up all those fish, you know?
Boy, it sure is better than mowing those big metal plates across the bottom of the ocean, you know?
Yeah, and we're not seeing that like we did before. Like I said, the port here, Port Canaveral, being, I believe it's actually now considered one of the busiest ports in the entire world, is no longer the commercial fishing mecca that it once was.
Right.
And, you know, 20 years ago, that the entire port was nothing but a giant commercial fishing plant.
Huh.
And now I think there's four to six shrimp boats that are docked in Port Canaveral at any given time, and then we have maybe another handful, a dozen or so commercial guys that's all they do is commercial fish, whether it's for king mackerel or whatever. So
you just described the majority of the ports on the California coast. They're like ghost towns.
Yeah.
You know, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Really good information, Chuck. Thanks for sharing all that. I love it. It's good stuff to know. And, you know, another beauty about kayak fishing, and I think I appreciated this in California long before I was in the kayak fishing business and when I was just a citizen angler. And a lot of our coastal fisheries, because of overfishing, because of bad regulations, because of pollution, through the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, a lot of our coastal fisheries suffered terribly. And into the 80s, 90s, and the turn of the century, we've paid more attention. We've seen fish stocks come back. But again, I believe because of the lack of invasiveness of the kayaks, that it's us on the kayaks, long before the party boats, head boats, and even the motor boats, we're able to appreciate a commercial, a viable recreational fishery. And I think it's because of the lack of invasiveness. And, of course, we get a little more time on the water than everybody else. But I saw it happen with the halibut on the West Coast, and I've seen it happen with the stripers on the East Coast. Some of the first guys to see that striper bite come back were paddling with lines behind them. And just another area where we are lucky again. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. Okay, if I take it out, Isaac?
I had one last word.
Well, then I'm in no hurry at all.
All right. Just going back to the chi of fish. The chi of fish, in my mind, really comes to sustainability and seasonality of fish. You know, various times a year you fish for different types of fish. That's because that's when they're in season. Just like various fruits and vegetables. You know, you have, you know, your early summer apples, you've got your fall gourds, your pumpkins, that type of thing. You know, by fishing, taking home dinner from the water, you're taking part in seasonal eating. It might be salmon in the fall and spring, trout in the summer, steelhead in the winter, sturgeon in between, what have you. Seasonal foods are proven to be the best for you, best for the fishery, best for the environment, best for the water. Become educated on what is available in your local waters as well as your local markets. Become educated, and by eating seasonably, our fisheries as well as yourself and our waters will be more healthy.
You'll feel better and you'll live longer. And Isaac, that is golden. Thank you.
Hey, my pleasure.
You know, on that note, I quit eating Chilean fruits because I realized I was eating fruits at the wrong time of the year just because they were there.
Right.
And, yeah, no more watermelon in winter for me.
Stick to the acorn squash.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing.
Oh,
add 10 minutes of exercise to the day if you don't do it already, and these little changes will make you feel completely different and a whole lot better.
Yep. And like I said, it makes you feel better, and it makes our waters better.
It is part of the path, I should say, towards sustainability. Okay. Don't you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Very much so. Really good point, yep. Isaac. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for joining us tonight. I hope you had a good week. I hope you have some kayak fishing in your plan for the weekend. And if not, like Redfish Chuck, maybe you'll just be walking the canals with your kid. But it's a beautiful thing, and it's what we do. Thanks again for joining us on Fishing the Wild West with Spike and Isaac Miller. And Redfish Chuck tonight, thanks for tuning in and contributing. I look forward to talking to y'all on kayakfishingradio.com next week. Spike out. Goodbye, everybody.